Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
That's all it took, details of the bailout to get Wall Street on board with the recovery. The Treasury Secretary released his plan to save the financial industry today. He tells us why he thinks it's going to work. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Monday, the 23rd of March. Good to have you here. A month ago, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner shared just the barest outlines of his plan to save the nation's banks with us. The Dow promptly fell 300 points that day. Today, Mr. Geithner filled in the blanks, and traders went wild. The major indices shot up 7% or more. We are talking, of course, about the government's plan to get all those bad assets off banks' balance sheets. Remember, this is the part of the financial rescue that nobody has been able to crack, not the Obama administration so far, not the Bush administration last fall. The idea, as Secretary Geithner described it today, involves private investors taking on a small fraction of the risk in buying those assets and the government guaranteeing against what could be huge losses. We will talk to the Treasury Secretary about his rescue package in just a bit. But first, here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson with the details of how it's supposed to work.
Think of this public-private partnership as a tandem skydive. Investors are nervous about taking the plunge, so Uncle Sam is jumping with them. Now, I'm not finished yet. If it's a success, the investor gets the same thrill at a fraction of the risk, with Uncle Sam promising to absorb the landing. Here's how it works. Let's say a bank wants to sell a pool of mortgages. The bank might hope to get $100, but according to the FDIC's auction, they're only worth $84. Enter the private investor. He applies to the Treasury, which gives him $6. He puts up six of his own, and the FDIC takes care of the other 72. The private investor controls the assets, which means he can sell at any time. If the market returns and the mortgages are sold at or above $84, the taxpayer and the private investor share in the gains.
There's a formula that basically allows both parties to share the upside, quote unquote. My fear is, though, that there won't be any upside.
That's Christopher Whalen with Institutional Risk Analytics. He thinks the plan's worth a try, but he's not convinced there's a market for these toxic assets.
They're trying to raise Lazarus. They're trying to reinvigorate these securities, which, as we all know, are busted deals. These are deals that nobody wants to trade anymore.
The Treasury Department disagrees. In fact, it expects buyers to go beyond hedge funds and private equity firms and include everyone from pension funds to individual investors. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Timothy Geithner is the Secretary of the Treasury. Mr. Secretary, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
The idea of this plan seems to be that getting the bad assets off the books is going to get the banks lending again. But given everything else that's going on in the economy, consumer confidence is shot, the housing industry is still in trouble, how can you be confident that this is going to turn things around?
Well, you're right. This is just a piece of a broader set of initiatives we're doing to try to make sure that the banking system is going back to the business of doing what it needs to do, which is to make credit available to businesses and to families, make sure it's making credit available on reasonable terms. And that's going to require a whole range of things. You know, the president laid out a housing plan a few weeks ago that's already helping bring down interest rates. We've also moved to put in place a series of programs that target lending to small businesses. We launched a program last week to help get the securitization of the secondary markets going again. Again, these markets critical for anybody who wants to buy a house, buy a car. Student lending markets all depend on these markets. And we're moving really across the board to try to put as much support in as quickly as possible, because getting the financial system working again is critical to making this broader stimulus package work.
Given, though, that there is some lending going on, why do we need this plan right now?
Part of the problem in the financial system is that banks made a bunch of bad loans over the last 4 years or 5 years. Those loans are still sitting on their balance sheets. People are worried whether there's going to be losses on those loans that might be large going forward. That's making it harder for them to raise capital on their own, and therefore some of them are pulling back on credit, shrinking instead of expanding. And to break that cycle, we need to provide a market for them to help clean up that mess. It'll make it easier for them to raise capital again, because we need them to be in a position where they're providing the oxygen the economy needs to recover.
Even if you can get the banks lending, though, do you think consumers have the appetite? I mean, they're already loaded down with debt. They've got other things on their mind than taking out a new mortgage or buying a new car.
You're right that, we're coming off a period where people borrow too much, and lending's going to have to fall no matter what. But what we need to do is to make sure that the supply of credit available does not fall below the economically viable demand for credit. You know, so you have businesses and families, again, that are, were careful and prudent. They've got a business they want to expand, or they've got a education they want to finance, or a car or a home they want to borrow. And we want to make sure they have that opportunity.
This plan depends heavily on the involvement of private investors, very heavily, who it would be understandable if they were gun-shy to get involved right now, given the drubbing that they have been taking up on Capitol Hill and in the press. Are you working with potential private investors in this plan to let them know that you'll protect them if things become politically difficult?
Well, you're right to say that to fix this financial crisis, we need people willing to take risk. If they won't take risk, then the government's going to end up taking on a much greater share of the loss and risk in this stuff, and we want to avoid that. So we want them to take risk. For them to take risk, they need to be confident that there's going to be a clearly established, consistently applied set of rules of the game, and we're going to have to get that balance right. We need to make sure that the American people understand that the resources we provide, the assistance we provide, is not going to reward failure or to unduly benefit a bunch of people to help contribute to this mess. But, of course, we also need to fix the system so that it's, again, providing the credit necessary for recovery. That's a difficult balance, but we'll find the right balance.
Well, how do you convince those taxpayers? Because you have two constituencies here, right? You've got Wall Street, who you have to make believe that this plan works, and then you've got taxpayers, who you have to convince that this is not just another handout of taxpayer money to private industry.
Right. We have only one. We have only one constituency, which is the average working American trying to get themselves to the point where they can do what every family wants to do. And everything we're doing is designed to make sure that we get the economy back on track more quickly so that they suffer less from the consequences of a deeper recession. That requires, in some cases, that we provide support to banks, but we're not doing it for the banks. We're doing it for the people who depend on banks, who need banks in order to, again, finance their kids' education or to buy a new house or finance a big spike in healthcare expenditures. That's the basic objective. We got one constituency.
It won't come as a surprise to you, though, that a lot of people out there in the country probably don't see it that way.
No, I completely understand that, and their skepticism and concern is perfectly reasonable. On the other hand, now, if you look what's happening across the country, even though we've seen some signs of improvement in some parts of the economy, you know, people are still under a lot of pressure. And, I think most Americans understand, most business understand in particular, that, you know, you need a financial system for an economy to work. It's banks that provide credit, which is really the lifeblood or the oxygen of an economy. And what we need to do is to make sure that we're doing what's necessary to get this economy back on track. And part of that's going to require programs like we announced today, which are carefully designed to protect the taxpayer interest, to try to get private capital to come alongside the government, so the government itself is not taking on all those risks.
The president said today, and you were sitting right next to him when he said it, that we still have a long way to go before the economy turns around. And rather than ask you how long that's going to be, I'd like to know what you're going to be looking for that's going to let you know.
You want to look at spending, because that's a measure fundamentally of confidence. And of course, there's a broad range of other things you can look at that tell you something about the process of repair in the financial system. Mortgage interest rates are a good example. Again, we want the American people to understand that the government is going to do what's necessary to get this economy back on track, and we're going to keep at it until we do that.
Timothy Geithner, Secretary of the Treasury, thanks very much for your time.
Nice to talk to you.
Tomorrow we'll find Secretary Geithner back up on Capitol Hill having a chat with the House Financial Services Committee. Members will be interested to find out what he knows about AIG's bonus payouts and when he knew it. Today, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said he would give Republicans in that chamber some time to chew over proposals to tax back some of those bonuses. Whatever Congress and the president do wind up doing could have big implications, not just for the bank bailout, but potentially for the whole economy. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite has that story.
It could be several weeks before the Senate votes on a bill to tax bonuses. Frank Partnoy teaches law and finance at the University of San Diego. He says it's unlikely the Senate will pass a bill anywhere near as punitive as the House version.
I think the House helped all of us express our collective anger about the AIG bonuses, but I think they're creating a lot of tension and some headaches for the Obama administration.
Banks and other firms might decide to reject government money. And if they don't take that money, they can't turn around and lend it to consumers and businesses. Charles Elson of the University of Delaware says there's also a danger that legislation like this could make the U.S. a less attractive place to do business.
We've always been viewed as a nation of laws, a stable nation of laws. And when we start using the legal system, the tax system, to punish people, I think you do run the risk of creating a debilitating effect on our reputation globally and making it a lot harder to attract capital.
Right now, he says, the U.S. needs capital like never before. President Obama seemed anxious to calm things down yesterday when he said it's a mistake to govern out of anger. Doug Muzio teaches public affairs at Baruch College in New York. He says it's hard to predict how the White House will weigh in.
This is a play without any script, and, you know, we're improvising all the way through. Everybody, the director, the producers, the actors, and nobody's quite sure how to do it.
He says anyone putting on a production wants to know what the audience thinks. But one criticism of this show is that its producers are pandering too much to the public. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace.
There were some, on the one hand, good news. On the other hand, wait a second, numbers out about housing today. Sales of existing homes jumped 5% last month. That, of course, is the good news. The wait a second part is that almost half of those sales were homes in some stage of foreclosure. That, in turn, drove prices way down. On Wall Street today, they only had eyes for Timothy Geithner. We will have the details when we do the numbers. This financial crisis has been full of twists and turns, not all of them pleasant, most of them unexpected. But there is one looming development you can safely bet your paycheck on, that Congress is going to be spending a lot of time coming up with new rules and regulations for Wall Street. The Senate Banking Committee will be exploring that very topic tomorrow. Banks obviously have a lot riding on the outcome. They're usually a pretty effective lobbying force in Washington. But this time around, they are facing some unfamiliar challenges, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Members of Congress are lining up to introduce dozens of bills to rein in bank excesses. For example, there are proposals to create a super bank regulator to sign off on new financial products, to regulate hedge funds, and to give bankruptcy judges the right to change the terms of existing mortgages. Scott Talbot, with the industry lobbying firm the Financial Services Roundtable, says while it's time to modernize regulations, some ideas go too far.
You have to balance the need to protect the consumers and the safety and soundness of the system without stifling the creativity, the innovation, the free flow of capital, all the hallmarks of capitalism.
The financial services industry is a prominent player in shaping policy. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, banks, hedge funds, and insurance companies contributed over $100 million to congressional and presidential candidates in 2008. But an Ipsos public opinion poll finds that banks went from a 31% favorable rating in 2007 to a minus 9% unfavorable rating in 2008. Scott Talbot realizes his industry faces an uphill battle for credibility.
The common cry is, well, why should we listen to you? You brought us this mess. And while it's easy to paint the industry with a broad brush like that, the bulk of the industry weren't bad actors and are working to change the perception of the entire industry together.
Recently, the House Financial Services Committee interrogated a panel of mortgage bankers, realtors, and home appraisers about the causes of the recession. And Texas Republican Jeb Hensarling offered some sympathy.
Sometimes we see public policy excesses, and I think we've gone from an atmosphere where a lot of you people would be brought before this committee and publicly slapped around for not making credit available to low-income people, and now to some extent you're being slapped around for providing financing to low-income people.
People who, in the end, couldn't keep up with their mortgage payments. At the same committee hearing, the chairman of the Mortgage Bankers Association, David Kittle, endorsed new rules to make mortgage lenders responsible for checking on a borrower's ability to pay. Those include better disclosure of a home buyer's costs and requirements that loan originators bear more of the risks of default instead of passing subprime mortgages on to third parties.
We know that these proposals will constrain some in our industry, but they will also help members and their customers in the long run.
Advocates for strong new regulatory oversight of the banking industry, like Gail Hillebrand at Consumers Union, say they'll do their best to take advantage of populist outrage.
The public is mad because the system is not working, and the regulators seem to have been asleep at the wheel. And so what we're pushing for now are changes that will make sure it never happens again.
Consumers Union figures they have a great opportunity to ban predatory loans with ultra-high interest rates, restrict banks' ability to raise rates on credit card loans, and impose powerful scrutiny over any future financial products. Bankers endorse some of these changes, but warn that regulatory overreach will make credit scarcer and more expensive. The first step in selling Congress on the soundness of their arguments will be to convince the public that lenders have their customers' interests at heart. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Coming up, how your lawn relates to the recession.
For landscapers, because much of their work is tied to several different small contracts, several different small employment opportunities, if you want to think of it that way, that losing one is not going to mean an entire loss of your income.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial soared 6.8% today, 497 points to close at 7,775. The Nasdaq powered up 6.75%, 98 points, finished at 1555. The S&P 500 hiked 7%, 54 points, met the bell at 823. Financials led the charge as investors bent banks will benefit from the plan the Treasury Secretary Geithner talked to us about earlier. Citigroup gained 19%, Bank of America 26%, J.P. Morgan Chase 24%, Wells Fargo 23%. I could go on and on and on. Even auto companies got a lift. Both Ford and General Motors drove up more than 5% today. Energy companies gained as oil spurted toward $56 a barrel. ExxonMobil gushed up more than 6.5%. Chevron gained more than 6.75%. ConocoPhillips filled up more than 7.75%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.68%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee discusses ways to alleviate global hunger. Amnesty International publishes its global death penalty statistics. The report looks at how many people were executed or sentenced to death across the world last year. And it's World TB Day, looking at ways to prevent the spread of tuberculosis. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. In the final stop of his trip to Africa today, Pope Benedict called on the rest of the world to share the Earth's natural resources more fairly. Remembering the continent's poor was the main theme of his week-long visit. It's especially easy to forget the needy when the economy slows down. Bioethicist Peter Singer says in his latest book, The Life You Can Save, it's called, that not only should we give more, even in a recession, it's unethical not to. I asked him for an example.
You're walking across a park, you see a small child fall in a pond. The child might drown in the pond if you don't rescue the child because nobody else is around. So, of course, you jump in. And you jump in even if you're wearing your most expensive shoes and you know they'll get ruined. If that's just something we would automatically take for granted as the right thing to do, then at the very least you should give up the equivalent of the cost of a pair of expensive shoes to save a child's life. And I don't think it makes any difference if the child is there in front of you or the child is somewhere in Africa or India.
You actually make the point that this particular moment in history is a pretty good time to be thinking about helping the really, really poor.
I think it is. I think that despite the economic downturn, we have the capacity now to make great inroads into the number of people who have to live in extreme poverty. I think we have the means and we're developing the knowledge of how to do that. And I think the economic downturn actually might lead us to think more about underlying values. I think a lot of people saying that, well, they're starting to reevaluate the importance of what they were spending money on and maybe to think about ethical values. And of course, that's what I'm on about.
You actually lay it on, and I don't want to mischaracterize this, but you make a very strong and a very pointed argument that it's unethical, really, not to give if you have the means.
I think we have to accept that in a world in which there are a billion people living in such extreme poverty that they may not be able to feed their children or may not be able to get basic health care for them or send them to school, and another billion people, that's most of us, who have a level of comfort that really throughout history people have not had before, I think it's unethical for us not to accept some responsibility.
So how do we do it so that it makes a difference?
According to the estimates that are around by people like Jeffrey Sachs, the Columbia University economist, it's not really going to cost us a fortune to make substantial progress on this. So in the book, I try to calculate some levels that seem to me realistic, starting with just 1% for people on an average American income, and then moving up to 5% and then 10% if you're earning more.
Well, let me ask you this then. Is a dollar given to the arts in Kansas City not as good as a dollar given to eliminating rotavirus in Africa?
It's not. I mean, I think arts are a good thing, but you shouldn't think of it in the same way. If you think of it, the world is one in which children are dying, and not just children, adults too, but according to UNICEF, it gives us figures on the number of children dying. It says 27,000 children die every day from avoidable poverty-related causes. If we can do something about that, isn't that much more important than Kansas City getting a new art museum or a nice new concert hall?
It's a question, though, of not only ethics and morality, but political will, I suppose, both individually and on the larger scale nationally.
It is. I'm focusing on the individual level because I do think it's going to be difficult politically to change. I mean, I hope that President Obama will keep the pledge he made as a candidate to increase U.S. foreign aid. I hope also he'll make it a lot more effective and a lot more targeted to where the world's poor really are. But in the meantime, there's no barrier to stop individuals from saying, I can contribute my share.
Peter Singer is a professor of bioethics at Princeton University. His most recent book is called The Life You Can Save. Professor Singer, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you. It's been good talking with you.
The recession so far has hit people in virtually every ethnic group at almost all income levels. The latest figures from the Labor Department show more Hispanic workers have lost their jobs than people in other groups, and their earnings are lower to boot. There is one line of work that's holding up surprisingly well for Hispanics, though. From the Marketplace America's desk at WLRN in Miami, Dan Gretsch reports.
For more than a decade, Rene Mena has run a gardening business among the manicured lawns and squared hedges of suburban Miami. Before that, he was a farmer in Honduras. In Miami, he's seen good times and bad. During good times, he earned up to $2,000 a month. These days, he says it's become harder to make a living off the land.
I had 120, 130 clients last year, but a lot of people have moved out of state or sold their homes or had their homes taken by the bank. I'm down to 100 clients.
People are getting their lawns cut every 2 weeks now instead of once a week. And they're cutting back on seasonal flowers such as impatiens, begonias, and marigolds, which once were an important source of profit for Mena. But one thing has not happened.
I can't remember the last time I saw someone cutting their own lawn, like on this block.
Attorney Frank McPhillips lives across from a golf course in Coral Gables. He pays Mena $80 to cut his lawn, another $40 to trim the hedges. Today, he hired Mena to prune a sapote tree.
You know, if you have hedges and bushes and grass, it's just overwhelming to try to take that on on yourself when there's so many other items competing for our time.
While Mena and his crew use machetes to chop fallen branches, McPhillips plays with his two children in the pool.
Daddy! Go, go, go!
Over the past decade, mowing the lawn has become like getting a haircut. It's something you hire others to do for you. The National Gardening Association says Americans spent $45 billion in 2006 on gardening and landscaping. That's nearly double what was spent 5 years earlier. Hernan Ramirez is a researcher at the University of Southern California. He says Hispanic gardeners are a regular feature in the suburbs of big American cities like Los Angeles, Atlanta, and San Antonio.
So you drive through these neighborhoods and you see these trucks filled with Mexican men or brown-skinned men from different countries. So they're the ones who maintain this really green aesthetic.
The boom in construction led to a bubble in jobs for Hispanic men. With the bust, thousands of Hispanic construction workers have been laid off, but Hispanic gardeners have held their own. Mark Hugo Lopez is with the Pew Hispanic Center. He says over the past year, repair and maintenance professions, which include landscaping, actually gained 12,000 Latino workers.
For landscapers, because much of their work is tied to several different small contracts, several different small employment opportunities, if you want to think of it that way, that losing one is not going to mean an entire loss of your income.
Lopez says people who are in construction are now crowding into gardening. That's led to a proliferation of flyers in mailboxes and under doors across suburban America. And it's led to a kind of price competition that was once considered taboo. It may never have been this cheap to hire someone else to cut your lawn. In Coral Gables, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Dan took his camera with him when he was reporting that story for us. You can see pictures at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, yet another example of what can go horribly wrong when you misuse the Internet. NASA has been running an online contest to name the newest component of the International Space Station. Comedian Stephen Colbert got wind of it, and you can guess what happened next. The next module of the space station will be named Colbert, thanks in no small part to the 230,539 fans of his show, The Colbert Report, who clicked his way. Actually, a NASA spokesman says the agency does get the final choice, but the top vote-getter will be considered, he said. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow shot up 497 points, 6.8%, closed at 7,775. The Nasdaq jumped 98.6¾%, finished at 1,555. The S&P 500 gained 54.7%, ended the day at 823. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, a sick economy and the very healthy business of outsourcing.
Companies in the past would have wanted to do it themselves. Now they have a headcount freeze or headcount reduction, whatever, and they say to us, look, can you do the whole product for us?
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.